Welcome to this week's episode of Freedom Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the TLS. My name is Thea Linarduti, and while my usual co-host Stig Abel is exercising his right to some of his 5.6 weeks of statutory annual leave provided for by the British government, I'm joined by my dear friend and colleague Lucy Dallas. Hello, Lucy.
Hello, well done for pointing out exactly how much holiday you and everybody else are entitled to.
Very important to, to know one's rights.
Yep.
What news from the allotment, Lucy?
Well, good question. How long have you got?
It's the question everyone's been waiting for.
It's a question, no, I don't imagine anyone is, but I'll tell you anyway. Well, it's harvest season. Hooray! Or it's the beginning of harvest season. So we got blackcurrants, redcurrants, gooseberries, chard. We will have peaches. Had the cherries. Cherries are done. Something else I ate the other day. Green beans. Not many.
This is a list of things that Lucy Dallas has eaten recently. This is a whole other segment.
But the thing about it is, it's not terribly bountiful. It's not like I'm coming home with, you know, baskets and baskets.
Blackberries.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's about five of each thing. But I'm very happy to have, you know, those things that I can hold in one hand.
To eat creatively.
Yeah.
Before I tell you all about what we have coming up on this week's show, I must urge you to subscribe to the TLS if you don't already. Subscriptions keep Lucy and me in our jobs, and God knows we won't make the best subsistence farmers. So if you live in the US or... No?
I'm just saying, I might. Speak for yourself.
So if you live in the USA or Canada, go to podcast.the-tls.com. If you live anywhere else, including the UK, then go to the-tls.co.uk/pod19, and you'll get 5 issues for just £5 or $5. Coming up, we'll be focusing on visual arts and music. This week, we have a special focus on the latter. When Irving Sandler wrote his seminal history of abstract expressionism, he neglected to mention 5 quite important artists who happened to be women. Jenny Quilter joins us to put them back in the frame. Laura Tunbridge will tell us about the interconnected, complicated and often contradictory myths and realities that link Chopin, Schumann and Brahms. And Lucy Dallas, who is after all our music editor, will take us from these romantics through the blues and onto the poetic pop of the Pet Shop Boys.
If you hear the names Chopin, Schumann and Brahms, do you think of great geniuses and tempestuous lives, tragic virtuosi not bound by the laws that govern the rest of us? This is what the myths and maybe some of the music would have us believe, and they are enticing stories and not untrue. But the romantic idea of romantic composers is, of course, a partial one, and it doesn't always help us to understand the people and the circumstances that help to create their work, which is the reason we're interested in the first place. This week, Professor Laura Tunbridge, who specialises in German Romanticism, has written about this for us, reviewing major new biographies of Chopin and Schumann and a set of essays on Brahms in context. Laura, many thanks for joining us. You start your piece by telling the flip side, as it were, of quite a well-known story about Chopin and Schumann. When they were both very young, Schumann reviewed a Mozart variation by Chopin and with sort of fantastical praise and heralded the arrival of a genius. But you tell us that Chopin was amused by this because he thought that Schumann's interpretation was basically a bit bogus. Is your point that they were really very different characters and not a sort of romantic band of brothers?
Precisely, that the way that they thought about music and what music could do and what music might mean to people was very different. So Chopin preferred to think of music in quite abstract terms, whereas Schumann tended to add stories and images to his music, at least at that stage in his career. So in terms of their artistic outlooks, actually they were fairly different, even if they admired each other. I think at this point it was mostly one way that Schumann admired Chopin. I'm not sure that Chopin was so terribly interested in Schumann.
Mm-hmm. And were they different in their personal lives? There's a couple of good stories about the way Chopin travelled and generally gadded about places.
Yeah, I mean, he had a much more cosmopolitan career in lots of ways, travelling from Poland to France and then travelling around Europe and to the UK. Schumann was much more bound to Germany, was a family man as opposed to having a string of lovers as Chopin tended to do. So they were quite different in that sense. They had some similarities. They were quite sociable, a bit picky about their friends, but had quite strong friendships, quite enjoyed taking the mickey out of people. Chopin in particular was renowned for being a good mimic. and impersonating people, which isn't something that you really think of, and kind of goes against the idea that he was interested in abstract music in some way.
How important was Polishness to Chopin?
It was very important to him, but at a distance, because he spent actually the majority of his career in Paris and elsewhere. So whilst he maintained strong links through friends and family with Poland, he never returned there to live. So you have him kind of imagining a Polish identity for himself, which makes it no less important, but in some ways slightly fictional.
And it influenced his music to a certain extent, didn't it?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, in terms of what kinds of dance forms he chooses, mazurkas, polonaises, that kind of thing, he's choosing forms which invoke Polish identity. So from that point of view, yes, it feeds into his music very much.
Mm-hmm. And both of them, Schumann and Chopin, they tried to control their legacies, didn't they? You talk about it. Do you think it worked? And how did the 19th century biographers treat them?
19th century biographers, a bit like 21st century biographies, are more interested in the stories around them and finding out the what they think is the real story beneath everything. So Chopin tried to destroy a lot of his letters and compositions. Thankfully, I suppose, people didn't obey his orders. Schumann was different because he tried to catalogue everything and collect. He was always a collector, and he was almost trying to create his own archive before his death. And interestingly, that didn't really prevent people from digging around and finding out the scandalous side of his life any less than they did with Chopin. So there's, as you mentioned, that sense of wanting to find the kind of romantic myth around these composers, and listening to people who had known him, known them earlier in their lives and had stories about them or had rumours about how they behaved, and in some ways taking more notice of them than actually what documentation existed. So there was an attempt to control and an interest in telling their lives, but these weren't necessarily pointers that were heeded by the people who came to write the first biographies.
Those biographies contributed to that myth-making, did they? Especially around the Schumann household was particularly... Because there's a very, very dramatic storyline that's got art and creativity on illness and forbidden love. But there's also quite a domestic one that you mentioned, which involves looking after lots and lots of children and having to pay the bills and having to run a kind of rather large house in quite a practical way, isn't there?
There it certainly is. And so you have all the professional side of the Schumann family. So both of them are active musicians. They do have eight children and need to make money to support themselves and work really hard. But that's not the kind of thing that biographers tend to be interested in. It's the typical thing of telling artists' lives, and you don't actually want to know about the days that they're spending at their desk just creating things. You tend to want to know about what they do in their spare time. But that's not necessarily a reflection of the artistic life, at least in a fullest sense. So it's interesting to try and put a little bit more kind of practical history into play and think about the stories that get told around them, but how much that actually fed into how they live their lives on a day-to-day level. Well, it doesn't maybe make for such a sort of scandalous story, but it sort of adds more historical grit to what we're thinking about and how we understand their music.
Well, in fact, trying to work out how Chopin, for example, subsisted, because, you know, he taught and he was sustained by Jane Stirling. I'd never heard of Jane Stirling, and I'm very intrigued by her and her story. Could you tell us a little bit about what she did for him?
She was Scottish. She was one of his piano pupils. And what she really provided was financial support, in large part. She also introduced him to a lot of people. She took him up to Scotland on tour as an effort to partly get him away from things that were troubling him, but also for financial and fame reasons.
Did he request three seats on the train?
Yes, no, I think he required quite a lot of looking after, and he wasn't in any way as grateful to Jane Stirling and the other women who tended to look after him as he probably should have been. So she had this passion for him that wasn't reciprocated, and she put that instead into, you know, paying his rent and organizing tours and looking after his legacy and his family as well. So you have these women who in some ways are facilitating the artist's life and just get forgotten quite often or dismissed because, you know, they weren't serious love interests, so they didn't really have a bearing on his artistic life, and so we don't need to worry about them too much. And it's a great shame because in some ways they're the people who actually allowed the composer to do what he did.
Well, indeed, and you tell a lovely story about her, Jane Stirling, kind of safeguarding his legacy and looking after him and his family, where after his death she purchased some of Chopin's most valuable belongings, including a Sèvres porcelain service, gifts from Baron de Rothschild and his Pleyel piano, and had them shipped to his mother and sister back in Warsaw. The lengths she went to, it's just tragic, I suppose.
It is tragic. And then she also commissions the very famous painting of Chopin on his deathbed, and she's slightly disappointed that she's not among the figures who are around him.
I bet.
And you think, well, surely she should have been. I mean, she wouldn't maybe be recognised by everybody looking at the picture, but on the other hand, she's a person who's actually made it happen.
But again, that doesn't fit, does it, into the story of the romantic genius? Just kind of, you don't hear about the romantic genius needing three seats on the train.
I think we need to explain that.
Yes, we do. Sorry, we were calling him Three Seats Chopin in the office after you said
yes,
this.
Yes, right, okay.
Because do you want to tell how he travelled?
Well, his publisher arranged that he could have three seats on the train, so he had one for himself, one to put his feet on, and one for his manservant.
That's the way I travel.
That's how we'd all like to travel.
I would too. I mean, in his defence, he was unwell. At the same time, I was, slightly floored by this idea that publishers would do that for their musicians. I don't think it's something they would tend to do for most people today.
No, I don't think so, no. Just to go back to a point of one of the differences between them, I wondered if you could give us a layman's guide to what you alluded to earlier, which is the difference between the idea of abstract or absolute music, which people tend to think of Chopin and Brahms in that sense, and programmatic music, which is more associated with Schumann.
Yeah, so you have abstract music, which is the play of forms, is purely instrumental, is about the patterns of repetition and development that you can hear as the piece goes on. Programmatic music is associated with extra musical meaning. So it's music that has a sense that it's bearing a story, which might come from texts which are provided by the composer in a title or in a poem or a piece of an essay that is attached to the music. And so in order to understand it fully and to understand how it's structured, you need to have some sense of that extra musical element. Someone like Schumann writes music which are character pieces, which are portraits of people, some of which are fictional, some of which are from his real life. And he also has a strong sense that music can represent things, which might be emotional, but also can be pictorial as well. So landscapes or dances can be considered programmatic in that way.
And in fact, you make the point that Brahms, who is often thought of as being terribly serious and abstract, was actually quite pragmatic about rearranging things to be played at home and writing popular, quite folky pieces for amateur choirs. And in fact, we're going to hear a little bit of one of them, which is the Liebesliederwalzer, which is Opus 52.
So, Laura, how did the lives of Schumann and Brahms come together then?
The story goes that Brahms turned up on the Schumann's doorstep in Düsseldorf in September 1853. He was a 21-year-old young man from Hamburg, and he played Schumann some of his music, and Schumann ran out of the room to get Clara and said, young man is a genius. And he then writes an essay. He comes out of retirement as a music critic to write his last piece as a critic, heralding Brahms as breaking new paths, as being the saviour of German music. So that's the conventional story. And so there's this epiphany of Schumann's that there is somebody to come and take over the mantle and will save the progress of German music from contemporaries like Wagner and Liszt.
Might this be a bit of a myth?
So there are lots of ways in which, I mean, yes, Brahms did show up and the Schumanns were smitten by him, and it was a really fruitful relationship between them. There are lots of things that could have gone wrong. I mean, Brahms had turned up the previous day and the Schumanns weren't in, only the children were at home. So that's a slightly different way of imagining this dramatic arrival on their doorstep. Schumann had met Brahms 3 years earlier, and at that point hadn't really shown any particular interest in his music. But this time round, because he was introduced via people like Josef Joachim, so other musicians who the Schumann respected, he was taken in more warmly. And then also it's a tricky thing because you have Robert Schumann writing this essay acclaiming you as the saviour of German music, but you're 21 years old and not everybody is as convinced. So you have composers who just want to bide their time and see what you can do. And so although it was really helpful for Brahms to have that early acclaim, it was also quite pressurizing in terms of people's expectations of what he'd actually achieved at that stage.
And then they went on to have a kind of long and complicated history together, didn't they? Both the households, yeah. And Brahms became, as you say, entwined with the household long term.
Yes, he did, because at first Schumann was very excited by Brahms's presence and starts composing a little more than he had been. And then within a year, he was suffering more and more from mental illness and attempts suicide. And at that point, Schumann in 1854 asks to be taken into an asylum, which leaves Clara with all their children and Brahms as their newly arrived friend helping out. And that relationship continues through basically for the rest of Brahms and Clara's life. They live into the 1890s. So the mythical side of this, or at least the romanticized side of this, is all about the romance between Clara and Brahms. The practical side of it is them running the household and Brahms helping deal with Schumann in the asylum and also managing his legacy, because this is still the mid-19th century. There is a huge stigma around mental illness. They want to protect his reputation as best they can, and it falls to Clara and Brahms primarily to make sure that his music is thought of in the best possible light.
As presumably there would have been stigma attached to a married woman living with another man, I would have thought.
Yes, I mean, when I say in the household, it wasn't
spending that much time with him.
Yeah, which is one reason why the rumours start circulating.
Yeah. But they never did get it together.
To cut a long story short, they never did get it together.
But I mean, they were obviously really deeply fond of each other, and there are letters in which he declares his love. But I mean, you know, we know there are different types of love and different ways in which you might express it, and it was an entirely complicated situation to be in. So, you know, we don't know.
We can romanticise about it. Laura, I've got a final horrible question for you, I'm afraid. It's a kind of Desert Island Discs type thing. If you could only have one piece of music from these composers, I'm guessing you'll take Schumann, but I might be wrong. What would you take to wherever it is you'd be going?
Oh, that really is a horrible question.
I'm sorry.
I'd really quite like to duck it. If I had to, there's a song by Schumann, which is Descendants Abschied from Opus 79. It's late 1840s, and it's just a really beautiful, simple lead that in some ways shows how he's in between Chopin and Brahms, but very much his own man. I'm going to go for that. That's
beautiful.
Right.
Thank you. We're all going to go away and listen to that. Thank you very much for talking to us.
You're welcome.
Now, Lucy, we're going to move seamlessly from 19th century European Romanticism to the 20th century Mississippi Delta blues. How are we going to do that?
Well, I think we're just going to have to jump in there. Yeah, we've got an excellent piece. Because it's the music issue this week, we've got a wonderful piece by Russell Davis talking about Robert Johnson, who is very well known as a kind of, people know the name, but
not... Well, everybody thinks they know about Robert Johnson.
Yes, exactly. So the popular myth, we're on myths again, is that there was a sort of guy who travelled around and played the guitar a bit and suddenly got much, much better. Why did he get so much better? Because he went to the crossroads and he met the devil and he sold his soul, and the devil made him brilliant at the guitar and just sound wonderful. And then he died early as a result of that.
He died at the age of 27, becoming a part of that, you know, the 27 Club, which is another kind of myth-making thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
In fact, the story's rather different, I mean, it's still pretty dramatic.
It is. As far as we know, he didn't meet the devil, but Russell Davis talks about there's a new biography of him in which they've been incredibly thorough and looked through his life. And he was a kind of itinerant musician. And at some point he fell under the tutelage of, in fact, a human, not the devil, a human called Ike Zimmerman, who was a very, very good guitarist. He seems to have spent some time with him and as a result got much, much better.
And he had a fantastic guitar, did Zimmerman. It was a Gibson, wasn't it?
He did, yes. He had a good guitar and was a very good player, and Robert Johnson got much, much better. But the bit about the devil, they think might have come in because he had a young wife and child, and she died in childbirth while Robert Johnson was off, you know, wandering about, kind of getting boozed up and playing music. And he was devastated by this.
And the baby died naturally. As well.
Yes, yeah. So he would go in to bars and get completely drunk and sort of and blaspheme and curse God
the
for
devil's
this.
Music.
No, he just sort of cursed God, you know, for wasn't everything awful, which was incredibly shocking thing to do. And the biographers think that maybe this is why they thought he had the devil in him, because how could you talk that way about God?
But presumably that's what I mean. That must have fed into the kind of the myth that was being spun even then about
the blues
that
it
being
was
the devil's music.
Yeah, it might have done. Yeah, because also it was a kind of other. There is another line. There's always gospel and church music happening, but yeah, blues music is something else. And it was often it was quite racy and rude and salacious and violent and all that fun stuff.
There's an interesting link. You mentioned gospel there, but there's an interesting link between African American vaudeville and the blues, which I certainly had never really thought about. It seems to be something of a new theory that's put forward in one of the books that Russell Davies.
Yes, yes, exactly. And this is not a well known thing that the book, which is called The Original Blues, is positing that some of the roots of the blues are actually from African American vaudeville, which was kind of touring shows. And it's very difficult to piece together because the people didn't record, and they were quite poor, they had eventful lives, a lot of them died young as well, but you can just hear echoes of it in the stuff that comes along later, so it's quite difficult to pin down.
So you can only imagine that they were sort of sitting up on stools and lamenting, basically, kind of singing the blues in a very...
It was the blues, but it wasn't all. Some of it was kind of funny and a bit bawdy, you know, that side of it as well. It wasn't just sad, if you like. It was kind of all sorts of things.
I like the sound of Butler Stringbeans May, who was, as Davies describes him, a long-legged, capering presence, possessed of a rhythmic logorrhea which certainly deserves to count among the origins of rap.
Yes, he sounds brilliant. And he was apparently incredibly influential, but we have no recordings of anything that he'd done. All we've got is the echoes of people saying this is what Stringbeans used to do, and even that is fairly hazy, the echoes. But it's a really fascinating story and much less well-known than the kind of slightly corny old went to the crossroads and sold his soul story.
I mean, which we've all done. let's move from proto-rap then to synth-pop.
Seamless,
yep. Of course, as always. What's our managing editor, Robert Potts, writing about this week?
He is writing about the lyrics of pop musicians, a couple in particular, Pet Shop Boys and Kate Bush, because they have both, they both published them, I think, late last year. They published them as poetry or as, you know, books, published the lyrics, which always invites the comparison between lyrics and poetry. And we have to say that Robert's also on holiday, otherwise we'd have made him come here and do
Kate
Bush
himself,
impression.
Sing for himself. But he starts with a discussion, as you said, of the Pet Shop Boys, a particular track called Yesterday When I Was Mad. So maybe we should hear a little bit of that.
You have a certain quality which really is unique. Expression with such irony, although your voice is weak. It doesn't really matter because the music is so loud. Of course it's all on tape, but no one will find out.
I mean, there's a lot going on there, but what's going on there?
Well, first of all, also Neil Tennant is very careful in this book. He doesn't say this is poetry. He's very, very smart, of course he is. So he says, the book is called 100 Lyrics and a Poem. So there is
so
one thing in there
that
he says is a poem, and then he says, look, the rest of it is lyrics. But those lyrics, they're very accomplished, and also the irony of them saying... expressionless, such irony. And they found that a problem because they were very clever, and he often, as Robert says, he uses these personas to tell stories, and then later on it seems to be that people don't take them very seriously because they don't seem to be singing from the heart because they're assuming these personas, which is a very literary thing to do, of course. And in fact, they did it, we were talking about the Romantics, that's exactly what the Romantics did as well. You tell a story from a particular situation, and he said later on in an interview, it's obviously a failure of ours that we've given people the impression that what we do is some kind of elaborate joke because they're very funny and playful. But he also, there's a song of theirs called Your Funny Uncle, which is about the funeral of a young friend. When you see it on the page, it does look like poetry, actually, and it conveys the sense of a life cut short, you know, very movingly. And it all, you know, it all kind of stands up terribly well.
And certainly the literary sensibilities, and Robert runs through a number of them, but, you know, from David Lodge, he quotes Love is a Bourgeois Construct. That's from David Lodge's Nice Work. Then there's Paris in the Third Reich by David Price Jones. There's Stefan Zweig. There's Anna Akhmatova. So it's definitely, you can see why someone would wish to collect it in a kind of a literary publication as well. But Neil Tennant, well, and the Pet Shop Boys together, Chris Lowe as well, so they're kind of synonymous with gay culture in the 1980s, aren't they?
I suppose they are, but they weren't. They sort of didn't say that.
Well, Neil Tennant didn't come out until 1994 in an interview.
No, and
but they became very much associated with that kind of outsider sound.
Yes, and I think that was partly because of the personae, and also, as I say, that allows you to say a lot of things because some of it's very political as well. The song called King's Cross, which is very political.
Is that the one about Thatcher?
Yes, yeah, but it's all quite elegantly done. You know, it's not a kind of howl of rage. It's all very articulate, and elegantly turned, but it's powerful stuff, and it also works on the page, which, you know, let's be honest, most lyrics really don't, because they are very much to be sung and within the music that they're contained in.
From one, I would say, gay icon to another, there's Kate Bush. She's also associated with that scene, I suppose. Rufus Wainwright once described her as the older sister that every gay man wants, and as one of the artists who makes it appear better to be on the outside than on the inside. What do we get in her book? Because that's the other one that Robert's talking about, How to Be Invisible.
Well, as Robert says, she's very different. It's very, it's still very literary because she references books all the time from Natch, Wuthering Heights.
She actually hadn't read Wuthering Heights, though. She'd just seen the end of the TV production.
But I saw another interview in which she says she saw the TV.
And then went
and
to
then
read
she,
it.
I can't remember whether she wrote the song and then she read it. Or then she read it and then she wrote the song. I think we can say that she has now.
She's probably now read.
She knows what happens. Yeah, it ends badly. But she also talks about J.M. Barrie and Hans Christian Andersen, a lot of Joyce. And that's a pretty tricky thing to do, to get stuff about James Joyce in what was known then as the top 20. I'm not sure she actually got Joyce in the top 20, but, you know, she did that.
Mm.
But it's less elusive than the Pet Shop Boys. It's much more kind of evocative and atmospheric, and it kind of suggests things. And Robert says, what does he say? She's more engaged with archetypes and myths.
Mm.
And I think that makes sense, doesn't it? That it's and she dredges up all these weird things that you don't know quite where they're from.
Well, she sings about incest and...
That's from a folk song, actually, that one.
Right.
She didn't make that one up. She's sort of drawing on a folk song, it turns out. But yeah, that, I mean, that's, you know, just to take an example. Yeah.
There's a joyous silliness. Does that come across, do you think?
Oh, I think it does, yeah. There's one called Sat in Your Lap, which is about, I think it's about kind of knowledge and how you know what you know. And at one point she says, I want to be a lawyer, I want to be a scholar, but I really can't be bothered. And there's a really silly video with it. And it looks kind of amazing, but also quite good fun. She's not always terribly serious.
I think Robert suggests that the book itself sort of misses out on some of that fun by not including, I think he says it's some of the earlier songs, including Blow Away.
Yes, yeah, he mentions Babushka, which is pretty bonkers, if you know it. I'm not going to sing it. But yeah, there's one called Blow Away, which I didn't know. And it has this idea, they sort of chant in the chorus about Minnie and Mooney and Vicious and I think she says Holly and Denny, which is the idea of, who were all reasonably recently, apart from Buddy Holly, dead musicians.
Let's have a listen to that then. Dust, dust, low to the wall. Bolin and Mooney are heading the show tonight. Beneath, beneath, beneath So that's the line, Bolan and Mooney are heading the show tonight.
Yes.
Presumably Mark Bolan there, another member of the 27 Club, I think.
Exactly. So Mark Bolan and Mooney is Keith Moon, I think. And then later in the chorus, it's Minnie Riperton, who did the wonderful singer who did Lovin' You. Mm. So then Keith Moon, Sid Vicious, slightly less of a accomplished singer, but had also...
He did it his way.
Very good. And Buddy Holly, who had obviously died a long time before,
and who was also young,
yeah, and the wonderful Sandy Denny. And so she's got this, and that song, Blow Away, is kind of about, Robert says it's exploring the porous boundary between the dead and the living.
Well, it's like a seance. The scene that she describes is almost a seance.
Yes, it's like they're all having dinner. it's just normal. It's what you do if you're Kate Bush. I mean, she's amazing.
What do you make then, finally, of this? I don't know, is it recent, this thing of publishing lyrics in books in this way? You know, whether it's as poems or, well, I mean, they're not publishing them as poems, but they're, you know, it's Faber, for example. Is it sort of necessary now that we can't really rely on people buying, you know, records and CDs where they would have got the sleeves with the lyrics and all of that sort of thing?
I don't know whether it's, I mean, it's pretty, it asks quite a lot of it to put it in a book. They used to only do it for the canon, as it were. So they did it for Lennon and McCartney, they did it for Bob Dylan, basically. But recently they have been doing it a bit more. I don't know. I mean, you can find lyrics online, but that's not as nice as having it in a lovely book. I mean, nothing is as nice. I was struck by this when I was listening to Sat in Your Lap, the one I mentioned. Nothing, there is no substitute for listening to it with the music, because it's all embedded, and a lot of the effects are, you know, you can't get them without the music anyway.
And I suppose that's what we'd like everyone to do then, go and listen to the music.
Yep, go ahead, get your headphones out and have a good time.
Apparently, at some point in the 1950s, Clement Greenberg, the king maker of abstract expressionism specifically and visual art more generally, delivered a lecture to a room full of people in which he asserted that a woman could never become a great artist. No matter that at least three of the women present, Lee Krasner, Grace Hartigan, and Helen Frankenthaler, were themselves aspiring in their own ways to artistic greatness, nor that one of them, Frankenthaler, had been in a relationship with Greenberg for a couple of years by then and had not long had her first successful solo show. They were almost certainly not surprised by the statement, however, each being intimately familiar with the particular limits imposed on women artists. Writing in this week's paper, the art critic Charles Darwin points out that Irving Sanders' Defining History of Abstract Expressionism, published in 1970, includes not a single woman. Not Lee Krasner, or Joan Mitchell, or Helen Frankenthaler, or Grace Hartigan, or Elaine de Kooning. Abstract expressionism was, he says, a thing of whiskey and chest hair. A recent book by Mary Gabriel, Ninth Street Women, Five Painters and the Movement That Changed Modern Art, focuses on these historically underappreciated artists' work and inevitably on the circumstances of its creation, prompting all sorts of questions, among them, must we judge these artists' work differently for knowing who they were in relationships with? And what would they have thought about being grouped together and called great? Jenny Quilter, who has reviewed Ninth Street Women for the TLS, joins us on the line from New York now. Hello, Jenny.
Hi, Thea.
Hi. Five biographies is a lot to take on, and the result is some 900 pages of quite granular work about this show and that show. What's it like to read, and does anyone emerge as a kind of dominant figure among these five women?
I think the book is going to read very differently depending on whose work you're familiar with. I went into it having read about Grace Hartigan, Joan Mitchell and Elaine de Kooning a bit more, and I was less familiar with Frankenthaler and Krasner. And so for me, Krasner's life was one of the most eye-opening pieces to read about. I knew Krasner a little bit from, of course, her relationship with Pollock, but I'm ashamed to say I knew very little about her life, and it really was quite an extraordinary life. She said in an interview that I came out of nowhere, and she really did. She grew up in Brooklyn. The only painting in the house was a reproduction of Queen Isabella. She went to Cooper Union and then to the National Academy of Design. She waitressed in the village. She modeled nude for other artists. She painted china and hats. She joined the Artists Union along with Arshile Gorky and Harold Rosenberg. And within that crowd, she became incredibly significant.
That's presumably how she met Jackson Pollock.
Yes. So she met him because she'd been picked for an exhibition by John Graham, who was an amazing character that Gabrielle spends a bit of time on, which I'm really glad about because not enough is given to him. So Graham picked her for a exhibition. He also picked Pollock. And Krasner was curious because she knew everyone else who was listed in the exhibition, but not Pollock. So she sought him out and went to his studio. And she apparently opened the door, saw his work, and it sort of hit her that he was painting ahead of his time and that she knew he was going to be a very important painter. They fell in love. But I think at the time when they met, Krasner was already really significant in the downtown abstract art world. She was the woman who was picked to be put on every committee. She'd been the person who'd been very active in the federal art project. And so when Pollock came in to downtown New York, he had a number of contacts from California and he knew Thomas Hart Benton, but he really wasn't immersed in the world like Krasner was. And she literally showed him around and introduced him to everyone. And there are a couple of really amazing sort of anecdotes that Gabrielle has in her book by people who met Pollock and before they'd seen his work were completely unimpressed with him. He was sort of the silent man sitting in dungarees in the corner of Krasner's studio, and they really didn't see what she saw in him. And she brought him single-handedly into that world and sort of set him on his trajectory.
Well, and she also, you point out, she also single-handedly reset the market for modern art in what she did after he died.
She held on to his estate in a way that I think surprised a lot of people. And then she insisted that the prices be four times as high. And everyone thought that she wasn't going to get it. And then the museums, one by one by one, agreed to those prices. And all of a sudden you had prices that you had paintings that had been selling sort of for $5,000, $9,000 going for $40,000. And that had a massive ripple effect on everyone else as well, because once Pollock was priced that way, well, then why couldn't you price it de Kooning that way?
Well, and indeed, Elaine de Kooning, she had did similar work in kind of making her husband too.
Yeah, she did. And one of the interesting things about this book is Gabrielle has a kind of naturally beneficial structure, because the first half of the book really focuses on Elaine de Kooning and Lee Krasner, who are slightly earlier than the other three. And both of them ended up being in relationships that were very sort of pivotal to the downtown art world. So in one side, you had Jackson Pollock and Lee Krasner, and then you had the other, Elaine de Kooning and Bill de Kooning. And Elaine de Kooning was also incredibly influential in pushing Bill de Kooning's career. Elaine was gregarious, beautiful, intellectually kind of curious and omnivorous. She was an amazing art critic. And so she started working for Art News magazine and began writing pieces that other people perceived as being favorable to de Kooning. So when younger painters came to downtown New York, there was this sense that you could either be part of the Pollock camp or part of the de Kooning camp, that there were these kind of two poles in the art world. I've talked to some people who would say, oh, that was not too much of a big deal, you know, don't read too much into the kind of acrimony or potential antagonism between those two. And then other people really do emphasize it. I think it's probably the former than the latter, but it was quite clear that Elaine de Kooning did have a very, very clear voice and clearly pushed de Kooning's work, Bill de Kooning's work.
Jenny, I just wanted to ask a question about Lee Krasner, that she was so, she obviously, as you say, she was already an important figure in the art world, both for what she organised and for her knowledge, but also for her own work. And a lot of that was subjugated while Jackson Pollock was alive. That was almost a conscious decision, wasn't it? Or rather, it was a conscious decision on her part to say, I've got to push him because he's amazing. And it wasn't a sort of self-effacing, I'm just a little old woman, not that at all, but she genuinely thought that he needed to be known.
Yes, she genuinely thought that. I think also she was just really good at doing it, and she could see she was really good at doing it. Mm. And I think part of her sense of achievement with organizing in the WPA and in the Artists' Union was fulfilled by organizing Pollock. I think she knew she had a talent for administration and for the kind of bureaucracy of the art world and for that kind of work within it. And then she just turned it into Pollock's direction. She also found that she got incredibly dismissive comments from a number of people who are really critical to advancing your career in the art world. I mean, Clement Greenberg, which Gabrielle patiently charts, was particularly nasty to Krasner at various moments. And I think, you know, I may be reading into it, but my sense was Krasner was going to paint, but she didn't have to paint visibly inside of other people if they were going to be that way towards her. And so she kept on going quietly and just didn't bother showing people what she was doing for some time, because it just didn't seem like it was a path that was opening up for her at that point.
Does the book end up being much more about these women's lives and relationships than it does about their art? Is there much writing about the art itself? Does, you know, I suppose abstract art especially is quite a, writing about it is quite a difficult thing to do well. Does Gabriel pull that off?
I mean, having talked to editors, I know some of the issues that she may have faced. I think she does chart the art, but my guess is that the actual descriptions of art and analysis makes up about 10 to 15% of the book, which is a shame, because I do think we want to see a lot of the art to understand what these women were trying to do. But I also understand why it happened. Gabrielle is trying to chart a massive terrain, and there's just so much storytelling she has to get in about these women's lives that isn't generally well known. So I think probably there came a point where she wanted to put more art in and she just couldn't fit it in. It's already 900 pages. Mm. And it's not as if what she's writing is irrelevant or uninteresting. You know, there's a lot about the storytelling that she's doing that's still important to hear about. You know, she's trying to do a lot in this one book. You can imagine other people coming along and doing work with the art itself now that she's laid this groundwork for the sort of biographical understanding of these women.
Well, and in fact, the aim she sets herself is to tell the story of a cultural revolution.
And I think it's a little hard to tell what cultural revolution she's talking about at times because she's spoiled for choice. I mean, she's focusing in the period 1929 to 1959 in New York. So she's got her pick of the litter. She's focusing on women's liberation and the rise of American art as an international phenomenon. And I'd say, looking overall at the book, she's looking at the relationship between those two cultural revolutions in particular, and she's charting how the second subverted the first, which is to say how the growing myth of abstract expressionism blocked these women's careers or occluded these women's careers, even as they made great strides as working female painters in the same decades. So she doesn't say this directly, but it's clear over the course of the book that these women's careers proceeded in part because of the gains of women's liberation, but at the same time, they were also undermined by the growing art movement that was happening in the same time. She doesn't say that directly, and maybe because it's not a straightforward revolution and it's not necessarily a happy story, it contains some significant devolution, but that would be my take on what overall she's trying to do. I think it's hard to tell the story of a cultural revolution through five biographies. You know, Marcia Gessen's The Futurist History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia, uses the same structural conceit to better effect. But I think that's because she was profiling people who were thinkers and theorizers, people who were already using the phrase cultural revolution in their sentences. And I think it's a lot easier to transition from the micro to the macro when the micro already has its eye on the macro. And with the exception of de Kooning, who worked as an art critic, like I said, none of these women were that interested in making broad sweeping statements of cultural relevance. Then they would have hated to stand in for anything other than themselves.
Is that the same for, I mean, the book falls into two main parts. There are two generations of abstract expressionists, as I think you mentioned before. Did they both kind of feel the same in that respect? What are the significant differences? Was there an improvement in, you know, in the women's lot, so to speak? Did they overlap much? Did they deal with each other very much, these women from different generations? Obviously they would have been in the same circles, but did they kind of look out for each other or help each other out?
So they overlapped very closely. The first generation had been working through the 30s and 40s, basically in isolation and penury. No one had been paying attention to them, and then attention started picking up in the late 40s. And that was precisely the time when a lot of these younger artists arrived in New York. So you have this very tight overlap between the first generation who've been doing things for a long time and the second generation who are turning up, noticing what they're doing and trying to kind of absorb those lessons in their own work. So for the Ninth Street Show, which is the name of the book and the kind of the way that Gabriel begins it, that was an exhibition organized by the artists. So it wasn't generated by curators or by a museum, and it was almost a salon de refusé where 72 artists who'd been working downtown agreed to rent out a vacant store, and for 2 or 3 weeks their work was shown. And all five of these women were exhibited in this show, and they were already well known enough to come in to submit a piece of work and to have it accepted. But Krasner and de Kooning, Elaine de Kooning, by that time had been doing this for a long time, and Frankenthaler, I think, was in her early 20s. So they were aware of each other in the sense that they saw each other's work, they moved in the same circles, they went drinking together, they holidayed together. But Gabrielle had a hard time finding clear evidence of them actually helping each other because they were women. I don't think there was a lot of camaraderie because of their gender. In fact, if anything, there may have been a little bit of antagonism sometimes, because they were used, some of them were used to being the only woman in the room, and then someone else would come along. So Grace Hartigan said that about Joan Mitchell, that she was used to being, you know, the person there, and then Joan Mitchell came in. So I think there was a little bit of prickliness. There were some individual friendships between them. I think Frankenthaler was got along well with Elaine de Kooning. But I think overall there was not a sense of, okay, you know, girls, we're in it together, let's band up against the boys. I don't think that was happening at all.
No, and I don't suppose Clement Greenberg helped with that whole with that whole feeling anyway. It's a wonderful, I mean, there's so much to talk about in it, but can we just ask you, this is a rather big question, I'm sorry to ask you it as a final one, is it an important book? Is it saying something that hasn't, is it sort of articulating something that hasn't been articulated before, do you think? Or is it just a kind of, oh, how interesting, we know about these women and I'm considering them together for once?
Well, I think it is an important book. I hope it will be given to students in particular. Gabrielle did an enormous amount of research, and the book stages a number of problems that any art historian or cultural critic has to deal with. For example, how much to focus on the art, or how much weight to put on an artist's personal life, and particularly a woman's sexual relationships, which gets a lot of focus in this book. And I think you could, you know, you could be worried by how much emphasis is placed on sexual relationships when you're accounting for a woman's career. I think Gabrielle's has it synthesized a huge amount of research. And even if I'm wary of that impulse in general, I do have a great deal of respect for that kind of ambition. And I think personally for me, it really did change how I was seeing the world a little bit. And the weeks after, I went to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and I was going to a temporary exhibition and walked through their kind of abstract expressionism rooms. And almost immediately I noticed when a room was just overwhelmingly male, when there were five Rothkos on the wall, five Jackson Pollocks on the wall, and just one Joan Mitchell or one Lee Krasner, and how overwhelmingly those rooms were weighted in the men's favor. And I don't think I would have noticed that so quickly and so instinctively had I not read Gabrielle's book. And so I do think it's important in that sense. And, you know, Gabrielle, she doesn't really editorialize about the systemic misogyny in the book. She reports on it. She describes, for example, Clement Greenberg's particularly reprehensible comments, but she doesn't allow herself to get really angry, which I think is wonderful because it gives the reader permission to find it even more maddening. There were many times where I started growling in frustration as I was reading the book, because there were just so many key women who played roles in abstract expressionism that just weren't given credit. Like just one example, which I loved that Gabrielle focused on, is Dorothy Miller. Dorothy Miller was a woman hired by Alfred H. Barr at the Museum of Modern Art as an assistant curator, and he very quickly promoted her to being the curator of collections. She was there from the moment that he started paying attention to abstract expressionism. But in none of the stories you hear about Barr going to buy these people's art and putting it in the museum. I mean, there's a sort of a very important story about Barr going and buying Hartigan's painting and literally carrying it off the gallery walls from the Thibaut de Nage Gallery and taking it to the Museum of Modern Art. And none of those stories, Miller is there.
Yeah.
She's kind of whitewashed out of history. And that's despite the fact that Miller was responsible for curating a number of really significant shows at MoMA. They were called the New Americans shows. And I think she did 9 shows where she gathered together a small group of contemporary American artists. And that she was responsible for setting the taste of abstract expressionism at MoMA with those shows.
Well, so, I mean, it's clear, I think it's very clear, Jenny, that there is more to be done. I think we'll end on a note of hope rather than anger.
Growling.
thank you so much. That was all fascinating. Thanks so much for joining us.
No worries.
I mean, insofar as we can sum that up, in many ways, it seems to be a book about labels, doesn't it, and how they both help and hinder.
Yes, and I think it's interesting the way that they were doing their own work, which is extremely important to them, and they didn't, you know, like you were asking about the solidarity between them. Mm. Presumably they didn't feel that they had to do that.
No.
Because, you know, I mean, we kind of think now that we've got to band together, but they were going their own way. And also that's what I meant about Jackson Pollock. She was promoting his work. The work was what was important. Yeah. It didn't matter to them who was painting it.
Yeah.
But as it turned out, in terms of context, yeah, all of their work was basically passed over, and what was promoted was
De Kooning,
Pollock, yeah, Rothko, all of those guys. And in the 1959 show, I think she said there weren't any women.
Yeah.
I think, is that right? That they were just not even the new generation.
That's where the book ends, isn't it?
Yes.
The whole thing sort of reminded me of the New York intellectuals, and, you know, Elizabeth Hardwick and all of that set, and Elizabeth Hardwick famously putting everything behind her husband Robert Lowell and his reputation, and Diana Trilling did the same. They were all in the same kind of friendship group.
Mm.
And they put everything behind that, but they judged each other so fiercely, I would say more fiercely than they judged the male writers, say. And, you know, Diana Trilling came in for special criticism for taking her husband's surname for some reason. It's just treacherous terrain, I think.
Well, what, I mean, I don't know, but you sort of think, what, we shouldn't have to band together. I mean, it's nice to band together. It's nice. And it's helpful. But equally, if you want to just do your own thing, you ought to be able to, because it all ought to be promoted on the merits of the work. Alas, history tells us otherwise.
That is all we have time for this week. Our thanks to Jenny Quilter and Laura Tunbridge. Please do pick up a copy of the TLS this week, beyond the pieces we've just discussed. There's a review of Jim Jarmusch's new film, The Dead Don't Die, which stars Iggy Pop. Paul Kingsnorth gives an account of a move to rural Ireland, which turns out not to be the idyll he expected, as well as a look at the various homes of Virginia Woolf and her disparagement of her poor husband Leonard's greenhouses. Next week, we'll have Annie Erno Yukio Mishima in the form of an exclusive extract from the first ever translation into English by Stephen Dodds of his novel Life for Sale. There's also the story of the most formidable spy in history and an account of how imperialism thrived in the modern cigarette. Intrigued? Well, I hope so. Until then, from Lucy and from me, goodbye.